Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Karen Cam Radio Show. The intention of this show is to empower and inspire you to manifest the life of your dreams, whether it's radiant health, prosperity, loving relationships, or simply peace of mind. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Cam, author of the number one bestseller, Guide to Healing Chronic Pain, A Holistic Approach. And you can get a copy of the first six chapters free on my website. Just go to karencam.com. Put in your name and email address, and I'll send you the link to download the free excerpt, and you also get access to five of my most favorite Fast Track Your Healing programs, classes, absolutely free. So that's my gift to you. And check out on Facebook, too. We've got lots of stuff going on Facebook, and just the world is going in a very, very fast pace. So we do appreciate your time for being with me today. And I'm excited today about we're going to do a show on vaccines. Now, I know what you're thinking. Okay, here we go again. We're doing another show on vaccines and the whole vaccine debate. And, you know, I've had my fair share of discussions about vaccines. And then some interesting things happened recently. One is that, you know, a family member of mine posted something about, you know, the anti-vaccination movement and how it's going to be harming our children. And then there is a couple of, you know, university, I think, meningitis scares, and I can't even keep up now, you know, what scares were in different schools, and there was some thought they were blaming people that were unvaccinated, that, you know, it's their fault that they have these outbreaks, and we're like, wow, you know, why are these outbreaks happening? And, you know, I personally do not have time. I don't give vaccines in my office. I choose not to. I don't do primary care anymore. And same thing, I don't write prescriptions for mammograms and things like that. You know, the my patient's primary doctor, if that's what they want to do, and we counsel them, they can go ahead and have their primary care doctor do that. So I'm not sort of up to speed in all the research of vaccination. So I thought, well, why not bring someone who has done the research? And then most recently, two of my young patients who, you know, teenage college years, ended up, it was very interesting because, you know, I check in with their energy system, how they're doing from time to time. They're in trouble. They know, so they can call me or, you know, connect with me, and I kind of mentor them. And very interesting that these two people started kind of going downhill, and I was like, oh, that's kind of strange. What's going on? And, you know, we did some stuff, and finally, you know, they both said, oh, I got a shot recently, a vaccine. I'm like, what? Without talking to me first, you know? And they were like, sorry, you know. Like, I didn't think it was that big a deal. Everybody at school was getting it, and, yeah, but clearly one person had a chronic illness already and was basically started spiraling. And she was at that tenuous point where she was really, I think, doing really well in the healing. And, yes, there were stresses and stuff going on, but that was the one thing that went boom, and it was like a big lead brick. And it just, you know, was – and I was like, ah. So lucky for me as an energy healer, we can cancel out some of these negative frequencies from the vaccination. So we went ahead and did that, and everybody, you know, pretty much popped up back on board. So, like I said, lucky me, we can do that. But if I don't know about it, then I don't know that we can intervene. So – today I thought I would bring on Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, and she has been in this heated debate, and she understands a lot of the intricacies of what's going on, much more than I do, about, you know, our immune systems, and her journey is really interesting, how she got into this. So she does have a book, and you can actually go to drsuzanne.net to check out her curriculum vitae and some of the great blogs that she has. And her book is called Dissolving Illusions. So she's co-authored a book on this history of vaccination and the facts and the myths. And so I highly recommend that you get a copy of her book if you really want the nitty-gritty details. But I thought, lucky for me, that she agreed to come on the show today to answer my questions about vaccinations and, you know, kind of the common things that people ask about, you know, whether you're pro or anti or whatever. It's completely irrelevant. Like, what really is going on? What does the research show? Why are we getting these outbreaks If there are any good vaccines, which one are they? And what if we take all the toxins out of the vaccines aside from the immune components? Would that work better? You know, some places in Europe, you know, think it's ridiculous that Americans still had mercury in their vaccines for so long. Anyway, so if you do have a question that I do not ask in this program, you can feel free to jot that down in the chat area. I'm going to launch the chat. So if you're online, you can actually write your questions down. So if I'm not asking that already, I will go ahead and include that as well. So Dr. Suzanne, thank you so much for spending your time with us today.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. So let's hear about you. What's your journey? Like, how did you become this vaccine expert coming from traditional conventional medicine?
Okay, well, the short answer to that is that that can all be read in my autobiography, which was just released, called Rising from the Dead. And I go through my history from high school onward. But briefly, I'll tell you that, yes, I'm a conventionally educated medical doctor. I went to some very good schools. I have an undergraduate degree, a bachelor's degree in physics, and I went to Temple University School of Medicine in Philadelphia. Then I went up to the Bronx and at Montefiore, and I did a residency, and then I did a fellowship at Hahnemann and Medical College of Pennsylvania in nephrology, which is kidneys, and then I taught as a professor of medicine. I taught medical students, residents, fellows, and gave grand rounds attending physicians. So, you know, I know my stuff in nephrology. I know my stuff in internal medicine. And I was very happily practicing. I had a big, beautiful house. I had a dream job with people I loved working with, making $300,000 a year. It was great.
Wow.
Then in 2009, some patients rolled through the door and, you know, one of them practically yelled at me. I was fine until I had that vaccine. And it was almost like he had told the story so many times and no one was listening, so he had to yell it at me. And so I thought, you know, tell me more about that. Tell me, what do you mean your kidneys were perfectly fine before? He says, yes. So I thought, well, let me check this out. So I call his primary care doctor. I find out, yeah, no history of kidney disease, normal creatinine, which is a measure of kidney function, normal urinalyses in the past, no problems whatsoever. 2009 was the year that we added the H1N1 shot to the seasonal flu vaccine. So it was kind of like a double whammy of vaccines for flu that year. And so he was number one. And then number two came through. And then number three came through. And then I started doing something which, if more medical doctors did, they would start making the link between vaccines and diseases, acute diseases and chronic diseases, instead of calling it, and this is their word, the coincidence dragon is now their social media construct for when a patient says that they got sick after a vaccine. So if people took as good of a vaccine history as they do a social history and a past medical history, a lot of linkages would be made. But that's very much discouraged because, of course, it's all just background noise and vaccines don't cause very significant injury according to the powers that be. And so I had no idea what I was coming up against, because in all of my career, if I came by and there was gentamicin toxicity to the kidneys or non-steroidal toxicity or statin toxicity, I said, stop the drug. The kidneys are sick because of that. And everyone said, yes, doctor. And that was the end. The drug was stopped. No questions asked. Well, say that about a vaccine. I dare you. And the resistance that I was met with was so obstinate that it actually threw me into research, because I knew what I was seeing. And I'm still baffled as to why other doctors don't know what they're seeing. And I knew nothing about vaccines because I was a conventionally educated medical doctor, because conventionally educated medical doctors are given a sheet with the vaccine schedule and told that they are safe and effective and pretty much have saved humanity from the horrible place that we once were, and that we need to give them on time. And that, yeah, a few people are going to fall down dead and a few people might get some chronic diseases, but overall it's completely worth it because they have really eradicated, wiped out, decreased horrible, horrible conditions on the planet. So that was my knowledge base coming into all this. And so, you know, the questions from on high that were tossed at me were, well, what about polio? Well, what about smallpox? Why are you an anti-vaccinator? I'm like, I don't even know what an anti-vaccinator is, but what about smallpox? What about polio? Let me go see. And so I had a lot of my own questions, of course, because when this comes up, we do have our own questions. Just like when people ask me questions, they should be asking themselves and going and doing their own research the way I did, because it's available at your fingertips. And the results startled me of my own research. So the polio history was one that just really threw me back on my heels, and I ended up writing about 70 pages on polio in Dissolving Illusions. And Roman had been working on the smallpox history for about a decade, and so we wrote that chapter, and then we covered pertussis and measles as well. And so that book is not meant to be a comprehensive coverage of all vaccines. It's meant to show you, yes, there were death and disease and horrible things going on at one point in time, but it's not all that vaccines came along and saved us, because there were other things that happened at the same time, which included transportation, which meant that we were able to bring fresh produce and medications and things like that to and from. It meant that refrigeration was developed because of electricity, and so we could keep, you know, the foods that are very nutritious alive longer. And it, clean water and plumbing was probably one of the biggest health revolutions ever, because people were basically drinking their own excrement once they were becoming overcrowded in the cities. And so once that all resolved and the child labor laws resolved, what we saw was a dramatic decrease in the death rate, over 99% decrease in the death rate from measles. And so my critics say, well, yeah, but, you know, we still saw lots and lots of measles, and now we don't. So you're dangerous. And the fact is, yeah, we did see lots and lots of measles, but when you have the death rate going down and you see the benefit of, now, I don't believe that all infectious diseases are beneficial, but it is a proven fact that someone that has had measles compared to someone that hasn't had measles, the person that has had measles has a lower death rate from other infectious diseases into the future, and has had their immune system primed in a beneficial way that it's able to fight pathogens. It's called a Th1 slant. And that is a well-established fact throughout immunology. Regardless of what Paul Offit or any other of the kingpins of vaccinology say, that is a proven fact in the medical literature. And I've done several talks where I cite the PMID numbers to show that not only is true in Africa, but it was true in America. And
wow,
so,
that's,
you know,
amazing.
The history is very complicated, and there are lots of arguments to be made for and against vaccines. And of course, we can address any of those now if you'd like to.
Yeah. Oh, this is really, really interesting. So, you know, we heard about some, you know, in your articles, you talked about, you know, the sanitation rate. And is it true that on the graphs of, you know, when vaccines were, you know, introduced, that the death rate and, I don't know about the incidence rate, I'm not sure if I was looking at that correctly, was going down long before the vaccines were actually introduced? Is that true? And for which disease is that true for?
Yeah, I mean, and that's really the key, is that I don't paint all vaccines with the same brush, and nobody should. So, you know, back around the time of, you know, the major epidemics, there was a pertussis vaccine that was developed around the 1940s. There was a tetanus vaccine that was developed around the same time. Then there was a measles vaccine that was developed in the United States that was released in the early 1960s. And then abroad, it didn't go onto their schedules until sometimes much later in Scandinavia into the 1980s. So it really depends on what country you're looking at and what vaccine you're talking about. But if we just stick, you know, because measles is a really hot topic today. So if you look at the measles, the death rate was already down close to baseline before the vaccine came in, and then the vaccine came in and the death rate continued to go down, perhaps at a slightly faster rate than it had been before, but it had no major impact on the death rate whatsoever. What it had an impact on was the transmission rate in the population, which is why we don't see measles expressing itself in the population like we used to. But think of it this way. What you're doing with a measles vaccine, and again, all vaccines aren't the same. A measles vaccine is a live attenuated vaccine, and that I'll get into what attenuation means in a minute, because that's actually really important. So you're injecting a case of the disease. So it's not like you're sparing this person a measles virus infection at all. You're just giving them what is considered to be a safer case of measles so that they can develop immunity, so that when they're later exposed to the wild virus or other vaccine viruses, which happens all the time, that they'll, you know, have some immunity to that for some period of time. About 2 to 10% of people never develop immunity, even after one or two vaccines. And then you have the wearing off of the vaccine, which happens anywhere between probably 10 and 30 years. The vaccines wear off, as opposed to, you know, if you get the wild type infection, you're immune for life. So when you think of attenuation, this is something that a lot of people don't understand, and I actually didn't understand until very recently. In order to get this virus to behave so that when you inject it into somebody, you don't kill them, because actually in the beginning, the early vaccines caused more problems than they prevented because they didn't understand this. So the first vaccines for measles were killed, and they actually caused something called antibody-dependent enhancement, which caused horrible diseases if the people were later exposed to measles virus. So they abandoned that one, but not until they had distributed 1.5 to 2 million of those doses. And so, you know, then they started with a somewhat attenuated vaccine. And what attenuation, how you do it is you get a live virus from some child's blood or they're breathing it out somehow, you capture it. And you start what they call passaging it through other cell lines. They can be human cell lines, they can be monkey cell lines, chicken, you know, they use embryos and chorion, fibroblasts, all kinds of different cell lines until they mutate. And then you pluck out the ones that you think are going to be less virulent. So say the ones that maybe die at a lower temperature or just aren't as strong for one reason or the other. And then you magnify those on other cell lines later. So you can imagine the interface with different animal cell lines that happens from start to finish. Now, what's really important, in my opinion, about the measles vaccine to understand that virus is that how it infects the body is very different. And so when you inhale a wild measles virus, there's a very structured way that it gets into the body. And there's basically three layers of immune defense. So you start the outer layer and then the middle layer and then the deeper layer where you get memory. And by the time you get to that deeper layer, the top two layers are functioning kind of like an orchestra all together. And then in the end, you have memory to it, which is very deep and long lasting. So the CD150 is how it gets into your body through the lungs and then makes its way deeper and deeper. Now, when you give a vaccine, what a lot of people don't realize is that because that virus has been passaged through monkey cells in the past, it has mutated and it has adapted to enter through something called the CD46 receptor. Well, the CD46 receptor gives you immediate access to every cell in the body that has a nucleus. And the only cell in the body that doesn't have nucleus are mature red blood cells. So think of that difference. So it's a darn good thing that they figured out how to attenuate these viruses, because in the beginning they were making people very sick because they were not highly well attenuated. And so doctors were freaking out saying, oh, I've got to give this vaccine, but these kids are getting ripped, you know, really sick. So they were giving them immune globulin at the same time because they were developing fevers to 104. And so basically they were giving them an injected full-blown case of measles and then trying to deal with it, you know, at the time that it happened. And so, yeah, these kids got immunity for a certain period of time, but it's not the same as getting that wild virus infection. So they attenuated it down. So today's vaccine gets directly into every nucleated cell in your body at the same time. And it doesn't give you that layered, you know, your innate immunity and your trained immunity at the same time like a wild vaccine virus does. And so it doesn't provide you that long-lasting immunity. So everything you're hearing on the news about these non-vaccinators, anti-vaccinators causing all the problems is actually rubbish, because if you look at just the California outbreak, what you'll see is the distribution of cases, first of all, is completely different than it would have been back in the time of wild virus infections. But secondly, that something like, I think it was 18% of those cases were fully vaccinated. And you would have, you know, in the old days, you would have never seen people who, or it would have been like 0.01% of the time you could have seen somebody who experienced wild type disease and then got it a second time. Almost never happened. But the biggest problem with measles today is that the population that is most vulnerable, which are the young babies and the older people, are now more at risk, and it's because of the vaccine. So, you know, the media and, you know, the public health departments actually have a very well developed strategy to dumb down all the information to the lowest common denominator. They test the information to see what kind of response it gets, and that's what you hear on the news. And as you can tell, because I've only touched the tip of the iceberg, that the actual reality, the scientific reality of vaccination is far more complicated than anything you're going to hear on a soundbite from Ann Schuchat of the NIH or the CDC or any of these people that are trying to coerce the public into getting vaccinated after these supposed scares happen.
So these scares, do you believe, in your professional opinion, that they are completely real, or are they, are some of these fabricated possibly to create more vaccines that need to be done, or do you feel like, okay,
what
they're,
do you mean
they're
fabricated,
really real, but they're
like...
not? Well, just, you know, like sometimes there's some thought that, and people will call them, you know, conspiracy theorists, that, you know, there's always some sort of thing to scare people into doing something. And it may or may not be real, like whether it be the H1N1 or, you know, Ebola, or every few years, it's almost like on the clockwork when they feel like people are getting too happy or too peaceful. We have to introduce something. I know you may not be able to answer that, but, you know, it just seems to me that there's this interesting trend of this fear-based, you know, events that happened. And I don't know, sometimes I don't even know whether it's really true.
Well, you know, I don't have any doubt that there were cases of measles in California. However, there was, you know, a mysterious index case who nobody ever found, who mysteriously strolled through an amusement park out in the open air and never, you know, went to a doctor and was identified. But there were cases of measles during that time. There's no doubt about that. But you know what? There are always cases of measles, and a lot of parents will never even take their child to the doctor when they have it. And they might not even know that that's what it is, because there's a false sense of security in vaccinated children. And people who don't vaccinate and understand the pathology of measles might not want to take their child to the doctor because they don't want to be harassed. And they want to be respectful and not bring measles into the doctor's office. But there's no doubt in my mind that there was an outbreak in California, and that there was an outbreak the year before in an Amish community where 400 people that were Amish. There were no deaths. There was no encephalitis. There were no problems with that. But, you know, what the public today has amnesia about is that in 1989, there were 25,000 cases of measles in this country. And here we are today, like freaking out over between 400 and 600 cases of measles, as if, you know, as if Ebola is sweeping through the country and like a hemorrhagic disease. It's actually been compared to hemorrhagic disease. But to me, one of the most interesting things about the California, there are two interesting things about the California outbreak. One is that there were a couple of cases that were written up in newspapers that were caught in this California outbreak, and they were registered as verified cases until they tested them to see what virus it was, and they found that it was the vaccine virus. And when they realized it was the vaccine virus, they were struck from the register. So there was a baby from Alaska, and there was another baby from another state that I have both of these articles that they were diagnosed and then struck from the register because they actually had a vaccine virus. One of them actually got it from daycare. The other one got it when they were in California. But the long and the short of it is that what's really interesting is, because of all the hype that happened around that time, is that the vaccination uptake went up in California. And the closer you were to California, the higher likelihood there was that there was a vaccine uptake. And even more interesting was a report that came out in Forbes magazine, and the title of it says, "Merck Measles Vaccine Sales Surged as California Outbreak Grew." And there's a quote in it that says, "There's nothing like an outbreak to get parents to vaccinate or to help vaccine sales." So,
wow. So you mean uptake by people actually wanting to get it?
Well,
right?
I think that they're, you know, I think that even natural practitioners, when they're in that kind of environment and they don't know their core basics like I now know, they're going to say, just go get your vaccine. You don't want to be part of this, because they don't understand what's going on. And so there were lots of doctors and lots of parents who just thought, well, I don't want this to happen to me. Maybe I didn't get the MMR because my baby was too young at the time, but now maybe they're 3 or 4 and I'm willing to go and get it because I don't want this to happen. And because they were on talking about Roald Dahl and his, you know, the guy that wrote Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, who years ago had a daughter die of encephalitis after having measles, probably after feeding her candy, but we don't hear any of that. So this child dies, and then Roald Dahl all of a sudden, like, I'm not an expert because I'm not an immunologist, but we're all supposed to be listening to Roald Dahl, who is a writer who had a child die from, and so the heartstrings were pulled left, right, and center by these anecdotal stories that were published. It was like the 911 with the planes, you know, all we saw was Roald Dahl and all these anecdotal cases of children that had encephalitis after being infected with measles. Meanwhile, we're ignoring the massive amounts of encephalitis that happen after measles vaccination, as well as other vaccinations, and we're told that they are coincidence dragons and that the parents are being dramatic and that there's nothing to do with vaccines. We have an epidemic in this country. And do I think that autism is totally related to MMR? No, I don't. But there's no doubt about it that there is a large chunk of those autistic patients who have a lot going on up to that point. And when that MMR needle goes in, that's the straw that breaks the camel's back.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense.
So if we consider
that.
So
just to clarify, just about the measles in California. So do they know exactly what percentage is so-called wild and what percentage is, you know, vaccine-related measles, so-called infection?
Well, they didn't, as far as I know, they didn't test all of them. But I think that most of it was probably the wild virus. I mean, from what I've read, you know, they did test a lot of them, and they were not, the most of them were not found to be vaccine virus. But the one case that I know for sure of that was found to be vaccine virus, that baby from Alaska, was struck from the record. And this is what they do. This is what they've done from polio, from every vaccine, is that if you get the disease from the vaccine, you're no longer considered to actually have the disease. So you're not counted.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So why do you think that, given that we have, you know, great water and good quality food and everything like that, why would measles raise its head again in our modern world?
Well, measles is never going to be eradicated with the vaccines that we have today. So people that talk about the fact that our vaccination rates aren't high enough, again, they're either talking out of school or they've got another agenda, because some of the most admired experts in the vaccination field, like Gregory Poland, has been quoted as saying that the current vaccine that we're using is incapable of eradicating measles and that it's time for us to develop new measles vaccine. So that means that if all of us got vaccinated 2 and 3 times and measles was brought into the population, there's still going to be cases and outbreaks that will happen. Now, the transmission rate might be lower depending on how many vaccines are given. And but that vaccine, so there's also another problem that nobody wants to address, nobody wants to talk about, and there's a lot of denialism going on, but there are Chinese scientists who are writing about mutant strain of measles virus that is it basically has developed as a result of wild virus interfacing with vaccinated person's blood. And so that's called vaccine viral escape. So that means that if you've been vaccinated, that you can't, it's almost like antibiotic resistance in that same sense. And that if a wild virus comes into a vaccinated person, because in China, you can imagine there's so many people and the dynamics are so intense that these things are going to happen there first than they are in less dense populations. You're going to start seeing them first. But there's no doubt about it that there are mutant strains that they don't know what to do with. And they're still saying, oh, we need to develop new vaccines. And so that's always what happens, is that we're allowed to say the downside of the old vaccines once we've got new ones developing in the pipeline. And so we see that with influenza vaccine. You know, I've got several articles that are talking about how if you've got if you're vaccinated 1 year, there's some chance that it might protect you from the strains of that year. But the following year, you're actually more at risk for pandemic strains because of the way the immune system is programmed. And so they've known this for a long time, but now we're starting to see it in the medical journals because new vaccines are in the pipeline that actually target different parts of the virus, internal parts of the virus that are actually the same throughout the viral variations. So this I've noticed this over the years of my research is really the trend, is that, you know, I see the problems with the vaccines, and then later they're spoken about only when we're on the cusp of releasing new vaccines.
Ah, that's interesting. So what you're saying is that for the flu vaccine specifically, that in the past, if people have gotten the flu vaccine, that the following year they're actually more at risk for pandemic, you know, getting other, you know, flu viruses. And this was not really reported until which time we're getting close to getting a new type of flu vaccine, which targets similar components in all flu. Is that true? Is that what
I mean, there's some really great articles out there. One is by Bodewes, B-O-D-E-W-S, and the other is by Hayward. One from 2012, actually that Bodewes put out several articles. Hayward put his out in 2015. And these are some of the most pro-vaccine scientists on the planet. And they're basically just talking amongst themselves and saying that what happens after a flu vaccine. Now, flu vaccine is different. It's a killed vaccine. It's not attenuated. It's a killed subunit vaccine, basically. And so that programs the immune system differently. It programs it more in the antibody arm rather than the cell-mediated arm. So the humoral immunity is what antibody immunity is also called Th2. And that's actually not a desirable way to become immune to something. It's not necessarily how you would become immune naturally. So when you inject this vaccine, you create lots of antibody. And that antibody can actually help you that year if you're infected with that strain. But what happens is, antibody actually feeds back in a natural infection. You know, the cell, it's not like we don't need one arm of our immune system. We need Th1 and Th2. They work together. And you need a balanced response. So when you have your Th1, your cell-mediated immunity happening, then later, the last thing that happens is you develop that IgG, that antibody. Well, that antibody actually feeds back to the cell-mediated immunity and says, okay, we're good. We've got our cell-mediated, we've got our antibody. Now, when you inject a vaccine virus like this, like a killed vaccine, the Th2 ramps up, you get body mediated immunity, and that feeds back and tells the cell-mediated immunity, you're not needed. Well, guess what? The cell-mediated immunity never developed. So you have no CD8, and that's your memory immunity. So the following year, when there's another flu outbreak, you're actually at a significant disadvantage, and that's been measured. That's been measured the year after in 2009. They measured this in 2010, and the people that took the vaccine were actually more at risk for pandemic strains and other strains that they weren't vaccinated for. So that's just a verifiable fact. There's no doubt about that. And of course, now this year, the miracle inhaled influenza vaccine was pulled from the market because they found, whoopsie, it's only 3% effective. You know, after having millions upon millions of kids inhaling polysorbate 80 and gelatin and live influenza vaccines, all of a sudden, it's not effective anymore.
But one of my patients, it's interesting because one of my patients actually did say, you know, her doctor said, don't bother because it's not that good this year, which is actually amazing, you know, to hear that. Mm-hmm. And then other times it's like, hey, we think we get the formula. I think they got the formula right this year, so you should have it. So it's kind of a, you know, yes or no kind of thing.
But you know what? Even if they get the formula right, let me tell you about another really important study. And this was Cowling from 2002, Cowling. This was a fantastic study. Now, if any of your listeners don't know this, placebos in vaccine science are hardly ever a saline injection. They're almost always another vaccine or, say, a hepatitis A
That's
vaccine.
That's crazy when I heard that.
An influenza vaccine trial or a hepatitis B vaccine, hepatitis A vaccine trial. It's the norm. So these scientists decided to do a very well-designed study where they used a saline placebo. And their primary question was, what happens after we give somebody a trivalent influenza-injected vaccine? What infections do they get afterwards compared to people who get the saline placebo afterwards? And what they found was really interesting. They found that for what they were vaccinated for, there was a statistically insignificant lower rate of influenza in the vaccinated people. But more importantly, what they found was that non-influenza viral infections were 5 to 6 times more common in the people who had the trivalent influenza vaccine injection. And the reason, and listen, these are rhinovirus, Coxsackie virus, echovirus, nasty viruses that can cause paralysis, some of which would have been called polio in the 1950s, nasty viruses. And the reason is just because of what I just told you about what's called original antigenic sin, that the immune system gets programmed according to the vaccine, and then it won't respond normally later when it needs to for the same infection or other viral infections. And so that's a really significant study. Again, nobody wants to talk about it, and it's dismissed as irrelevant.
Which study is this? Where do we find that?
Well, you can go to the PubMed website, and I'll give you the PMID number. All you have to do is plug this number into PubMed. It's 224231 Cowling, Cowling, awesome. C-O-W-L-I-N-G, in 2012. It's a fantastic little study that I think speaks volumes.
Thank you. Oh, it does. That's wonderful. I love how you have this stuff at your fingertips. You are so amazing. Thank you. Wow, that is cool. Sorry, I interrupted what you were going to say.
Oh, I think I was done on that roll.
Okay, let's switch gears a little bit to about the Gardasil. Okay, now, Gardasil, you know, I remember I was taking a test for, you know, board certification years and years ago, and, you know, they have you do these continuing medical education things, and so one of them was the article about the benefits of Gardasil vaccine showing decrease in, you know, these, rates of cervical cancer or something like that. So I'm thinking, oh, well, I guess maybe this really works. And then, you know, I saw this movie about this. The first thing was this cheerleader who basically got really injured by it, and then now other reports of that it doesn't. I mean, it may decrease those types of viruses, but other viruses are now coming up and replacing them, and so we're getting cervical cancer in people of age groups that we didn't before. So I would love for you to shed some light on the Gardasil.
Well, we would need all day to really, again, I'm not going to dumb it down like the public health departments will and say, get your vaccine because you won't get cervical cancer if you get it, because it's so much more complicated than that. And I'd also like to say that, you know, there's always a grain of truth in what the public health departments and the vaccine interests say. They wouldn't have gotten this far if there wasn't a grain of truth to their message. But there's usually only a grain. And so, yes, you know, cervical cancer, a cofactor in most cervical cancers is human papillomavirus. However, human papillomavirus is ubiquitous. It means it's everywhere. Newborns have it. Babies can get it from their fathers just from hugging and kissing them. Lizards have it. All animals seem to have some form or another. There are hundreds of different strains of it. And there are a couple that are more associated with warts, and there are two others that seem to be more associated with cervical cancers, at least in America, because in other countries, they're actually different strains. However, the more important message here is that HPVs tend to be a transient passenger in the vast majority of people, especially women. So if if they get a pap smear and they find that there's, abnormal cells, 9 times out of 10, you wait long enough, it's going to go away on its own. But if you, increase the vitamin D levels and get people to stop smoking and start eating well, you find that it's going to go away even faster. So it's by far and away, HPV infection is not a diagnosis of doom for cervical cancer. Cervical cancers are very slow growing cancers, easily picked up on pap smears if they're done in good timing. And, pap smears have been a revolution as far as decreasing the rates of cervical cancer. So this vaccine is not meant to replace pap smears. So, and, you were talking in the beginning about how you clear people's energy after vaccines. Well, I'd love to send you some of these girls that are injured from Gardasil, because I guarantee you, you're not going to clear anything out of them. Nobody can touch the types of injuries that I've been seeing lately. No practitioners on earth have been touching a lot of these problems. They're so incredibly severe. There have been deaths that have been associated with them, although the public health departments deny them, but the rates of crippling and paralysis and psychological disorders that occur after this are astronomical and debilitating in type A, high-achieving young women. And now we're going to start to see it in young men, without a doubt. It's really bad. And so, there are more vaccine adverse event reporting system reports from Gardasil compared to all the other vaccines combined. It's been a real problem. So we do have a new Gardasil vaccine, and that's kind of the story I want to tell now, because like when I was talking before, I said, oh yeah, we're allowed to say what's wrong with the old vaccine once we have a new vaccine, right? So the old vaccine covered covered strains 6, 11, 16, and 18. It had 250 micrograms of aluminum, and it's a type of aluminum that is unique to Gardasil. It's very tightly chemically bound and very difficult to separate off of the antigens. So after a few years, they discovered that a new vaccine was required. So the reason they that this new vaccine was supposedly required is because they were finding that those young women who were vaccinated with Gardasil, because of original antigenic sin that I spoke of before, were actually more susceptible to the other viruses that are associated with cervical cancer than the unvaccinated people were. Okay. So the second vaccine came onto the scene, and that covers 9 strains, and it has a double dose of aluminum, 500 micrograms of aluminum. And I think one of the really startling pieces of data when it comes to the new vaccine, and even if you just leave to the side what I just said, that the reason they needed a new vaccine is because not just because the old vaccine wasn't covering enough strains. These strains are just going to keep cropping up because nature abhors a vacuum. And when I said that, there's always a grain of truth. The grain of truth is that if you've not yet been infected with these strains of HPV and you get the vaccine, yes, your body will mount an immune response that will make you less likely to become infected with these particular strains, which by logic would tell you would make you less likely to develop cervical cancer from those particular strains, but it doesn't mean you're less likely to develop a problem from other strains if you're one of those very small group of people who won't clear the virus on your own and it will stay and cause a problem. But when you're vaccinated with the first vaccine, you're actually more susceptible to the other strains that have come in. So when they checked antibody titers to the 5 added strains in the new Gardasil 9, what they found that the titers were only 25% among those who had previously received Gardasil. So now you've got a second problem. And they were only 63% in the people who received Gardasil 9 alone. So it's still not a really hugely effective vaccine. And a lot of people think that all the vaccines they get, I'm immune to it 100%. Well, it's actually, if you take those package inserts out and actually read what they call the efficacy or the effectiveness, which usually means an antibody titer, you'll be surprised that it's not 99%, not 90%. It's usually somewhere between 50 and 60%. And then that's why you need a lot of injections, serial injections to keep boosting that after you get it. And so this is the story, a very, very briefly told story of the HPV vaccines. So in my opinion, you know, when you look at the effectiveness, you look at what happens if you've already had HPV and then get the vaccine, it's actually negatively effective. Another thing nobody wants to talk about. And then you look, it might be effective against the strains that you have, but then other strains are going to have more access to you because you've created a vacuum. That's the original antigenic sin phenomenon. And then if you've been vaccinated with the first series and you get the second series, you're about 50% less likely to respond to it because of being vaccinated the first time. So this is the complication that the social engineering media doesn't want to talk about, because you can't do it in sound bites, and because when people hear the full story and the whole story, they're less likely to vaccinate. And their very well publicized goal is to get you people to have the desired behavior, not to get you to have an understanding, because they don't think we're smart enough. They don't think I'm smart enough, even though I'm a medical doctor with a degree in physics and a subspecialty. I'm not smart enough to understand this sophisticated medical literature. So certainly you parents aren't smart enough to understand this, when the fact of the matter is it's far from rocket science. And I have seen many a parent knock a medical doctor back on their heels with the facts, because medical doctors don't know their facts. They only know their propaganda.
Yeah, I'm kind of ashamed about that. And honestly, there's so much that we need to learn and know, that we could spend all day after practice, you know, reading and studying about various different things. We'd have no life. And so we kind of depend on our journals as the say,
that's right,
as the go-to. And that's
right,
what we get graded on. That's what our medical education. You know, we have to get your CMEs, your continuing medical education, and we get graded and certificates, and we think we're doing our patients a favor because we are learning, you know, a little bit about everything. But we haven't had, you know, the time to go through this, which is why we have you on the show today.
Yeah, well, believe me, it's been a more than full-time job for me since leaving, and it's actually brought me to a really humbling place, because you know, back when I was a rich, you know, happy, successful medical doctor, I didn't have very much humility. I didn't realize how much I didn't know, not only about vaccines, but about a lot of other things. And because we are so rewarded like Pavlovian dogs in the system, you know, you go get your brownie points, your CMEs, and you give the right answers. What doctors don't realize is that they're actually on the other end of the social engineering as well, that they're actually very well monitored for the proper response, that medical schools and chiropractic schools are really how should I say, surveyed fairly frequently to find out what people are thinking and then how they can change the curriculum to get them to think what they want them to think so that they can change their whatever behavior it might be, in this case, vaccination philosophy and practice.
Oh my gosh. Well, and I just look back to when I first got out of medical school and residency, I was so gung-ho and so, you know, I basically annoyed the poor other doctors I was working with because I wanted to have everything according to the schedule and all the well baby visits. And so I created a form, a chart where everybody would, you know, follow through and check. And this is what, you know, the insurance systems and everything want you to do. You get, like you said, brownie points when you have everybody's flu vaccine. If you got somebody with diabetes, they have to have flu vaccine, and then you get paid mm-hmm. more. You know, and mm-hmm. That wasn't even in place when I started. I was just doing it because I thought I was doing right by the patient.
Right.
I did think it was a little ridiculous to have to, you know, poke some poor kid X amount of times in their first year of life. But I didn't go beyond that. I didn't question that. I looked at the, you know, the vaccine adverse form that they give people, and I said, well, you could get some redness, some fever, you know, treat it with Tylenol, and that was about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody did what I said because I was a doctor,
yeah.
And that's what people have to
do. And how many people brought their kids
really
back
educated.
To you? How many parents brought their kids back to you after being vaccinated and said something's wrong since the vaccine?
You know, it was so long ago, I can't even remember. I would probably say 20% maybe, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because I worked in a really low-income arena, and so they were very non-compliant, what we call them in doctor speak. So they wouldn't show up for their baby visits. You know, it would be like mm-hmm. pulling teeth trying to get them in. So I just wonder if because they didn't get it on time and we were trying to play catch up, that I actually didn't see as many as I thought I would see, like given the information I have now.
Well, or they didn't bring them back because they knew the child became ill after the vaccine and sure as heck to have any more of that kind of a problem. You know, and another problem with pediatrics is that just like you said you told them to take Tylenol. Well,
oh
that's
my
actually,
gosh, now I'm thinking,
you're not
what
alone
is,
in that.
What
I'm not,
did I
I'm not,
do?
Yeah, it's ubiquitous amongst, you know, in the training, Tylenol, Fever 101, you know, the admission orders to any hospital, what does it say? Fever 101, give Tylenol. So when these kids develop fevers after vaccines, which happens quite commonly, that's what's said to be done. But, you know, when you think about it, like the liver has really taken a hit after a vaccine, you know, even though you might not measure high transaminases or high bilirubin, the liver is working really hard. The detoxification systems, the glutathione, the, you know, antioxidants are really stressing. You know, the parents talk about the horribly smelling bowel movements that happen after vaccines. So the whole GI system is really taking it in and trying to get rid of it. And so you give them, you know, a pro-oxidant, something like Tylenol that basically uses up that N-acetylcysteine in the liver, and you're putting them at even more of a disadvantage. But beyond that, they find that the vaccines actually don't even work as well if you've given Tylenol either at the same time or afterwards. And I've got a study, I believe the name was Schwartz, that showed a huge correlation between rates of Tylenol intake and MMR vaccine correlating to autism rates. So, you know, there's a real problem. These non-steroidal drugs are a problem just by themselves because, you know, you're suppressing one of the natural, normal, God-given mechanisms to deal with microbial infections, okay? And so they're overused across the board. But when it comes to vaccination, you know, while it might stomp, you know, get rid of the symptom, it actually puts the child at a double disadvantage. But yet,
right,
even though most of our medical literature says not to give it, the doctors have nothing else to do. And what are you going to do? Like, you're like some poor, you know, automaton pediatrician that's just doing what they're told, thinking you're doing the best. And then these people are coming back to you. You don't know anything about herbs. You don't know anything about what the fever's really supposed to be doing. You just know what temperature you're supposed to treat. You don't know anything about acupuncture. You don't know the powers of breast milk. All you know is that you've got to get rid of that symptom. And that's what happens. That's how it all happens.
Yep, that's how simple it was beforehand. If it was, you know, not too high, you're good, you're good. You know, but then I'm not that mom in the middle of the night freaking out, you know, that their that their child looks sick and awful. And now, you know, I'm trying not to feel guilty for the past, but what I've done, but it's just, you know, ignorance, just little ignorance. And now I tell patients, even if they, you know, a lot of my patients are getting off medications or aren't any medications right now. And when they go through a feverishness, the automatic, you know, reflexive response is, this is bad. You know, this is bad. And I'm like, no. Your body is supposed to create an immune response to something. And actually, somebody just called recently. Yeah. She looked like, she felt like she had the flu. We were energetically able to test that she was actually healing a new infection, but that she was like 96% already cured within 24 hours. And I said, hey, you know what? Let's do some exosalts. Let's do some, you know, phototherapy patches, decrease the pain, and, you know, and drink lots of water and bone broth. She already had a great diet. So, yeah, it blew over. I mean, it blew over, but she was scared. But that's because people think this is bad and I have to treat the symptom, which, you know, sometimes they don't know what they're treating. And then their immune system actually gets blunted, like you're saying, and your detoxification system, like that poor little liver being given Tylenol exactly at the time where it needs to have support when you're given a vaccine instead of having its effect blunted. So, you know, part of this is really education of people saying, you know what, you know, this is your immune system happening. And, you know, connect with someone who knows what, you know, what's going on and doesn't freak out with every symptom.
Well, I actually found that my research on fever was some of the most revealing and interesting because I spent an entire summer a couple of years ago researching fever, and my mission was to find something in the medical literature supporting suppressing fever with drugs. And guess what? I couldn't. There's actually nothing in the medical literature that says you're doing an infected person any favors by giving. They say you can do it because it might help the child feel better. But one of the most important quotes I found in that in my research was by a doctor named Plaisance, Plaisance, in 2000. It's almost unbelievable. And it said, it has never been shown in humans that increases in core temperature encountered during fever, which rarely exceed 41 degrees Celsius, which is 105.8 degrees Fahrenheit, are harmful per se. So take that in for a minute. And then if you go to the Johns Hopkins website, at least during that summer, I mean, they're all talking about how, you know, fevers, yes, you know, you could end up with a febrile seizure. But what I found out is that I've seen febrile seizures happen in children as the temperature's coming down. I've seen it happen when the fever's really not even that high, when it's only 103, because it's really the brain likes things to happen slowly. And it's really about when things happen really quickly that the brain doesn't like it. So it's not absolute temperature that's really the problem when it comes to febrile seizures. And look, none of us want to see our kids laying on the floor seizing and biting their tongue. So I'm not by any means saying don't worry about febrile seizure. But the incidence rate of having long-term seizures after a febrile seizure are extremely low. And over and above that, there was a lot of medical literature that showed that in intensive care unit settings that having fevers actually predicted a better prognosis. So what I found that summer was really changed, you know, my confidence. Like I always knew, like even going through medical school, I just thought, huh, didn't they just teach us the physiology of fever about, you know, all the benefits and all the things that, you know, what happens? It's like the good fire, you know, like heat shock proteins are released and phagocytosis, junk eating cells are, you know, ramped up and bactericidal activity goes up and all this good stuff happens during a fever. And then you get into the hospital into your clinical time. and you're smashing down fevers of higher than 101 with Tylenol. So to me, it always felt a little bit strange, and I think it was more that that is a mechanism to keep doctors from being woken up in the middle of the night or disturbed during the day than it really is something that's actually good for patients. And in some ways, I wish the thermometer was never, invented or mass marketed, because it's really just been a tool to incite fear in parents and have them calling the doctor, who, of course, only knows how to give non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents and really doesn't know. So see, my take on fevers today is that I treat the individual with the fever so that they don't need the fever. And so I find that using, vitamin C is a really powerful mechanism to give the immune system what it needs so that it doesn't have to keep struggling the way it is. Fever is a really important, interesting topic that I wish more parents knew about, because I do believe that that is, that and antibiotics are some of the mechanisms that set the gastrointestinal system and the brain up for trouble later when that MMR injection happens.
Right. And the flu vaccine still has mercury. And what about all the other vaccines that we have in America?
Well, they don't all have mercury. So the multi-dose flu vaccines have mercury in them.
Right.
I don't think it's even all of the multi-dose. So you have to check. The individual dose flu vaccines don't have mercury in them. And then there's aluminum. Just about all the killed vaccines have aluminum. And the reason it has aluminum is because that's actually really interesting. I don't know how much time we have left. But the reason that there's aluminum in the vaccines is because the baby or the adult wouldn't respond to the killed microbe pieces otherwise. And the reason you wouldn't respond to it is because, the more important part of the immune system is actually to recognize what not to respond to. Because the proven fact is that all microbes have protein sequences that are similar to our own protein sequences in our bodies. So if you have an overreaction, and this is why the vaccines can cause autoimmunity, if you have an overreaction to those proteins that was stimulated unnaturally by aluminum being put in the vaccine so that you will have a, quote, immune response, then you might have that nice immune response that the immunologists are looking for. But down the line, a small percentage of those people are going to be subject to autoimmune diseases because of that similarity between the microbe protein sequences and the human body. And so they override that kind of normal quiescent state of the immune system by adding aluminum, because baby immune systems, not just because of what I just said, the protein sequences, but because baby immune systems are actually programmed for the first 2 years of life to be anti-inflammatory while that baby is learning what's safe, what's not safe, what to respond to, and it's being programmed by the mother's breast milk. So the aluminum in vaccines is a whole other, really problematic thing. I recommend that people go to a website called vaccinepapers.com and also go listen to my talk called Trojan Horses and Cluster Bombs, where I get really into the whole aluminum issue and the, what I'm just talking about with the autoimmune diseases. And the most common pro-vaccine arguments, which are, well, don't worry about it. It's the most common element in the Earth's crust, and you're going to drink a lot of it in breast milk anyway, and it's in formula, so well, drinking it is not the same as injecting it, and their arguments are actually some of the easiest to beat, because they're not based on proper interpretation of the available medical literature.
Ah, that's great. Great resources. And what would you recommend as far as if parents or patients decided, well, I don't want to, given what I, now know, I don't want to do vaccinations. So how do I, number one, as a parent, say I want to opt out, and is that even possible? And number two, what do I do to protect myself or my children from getting illnesses like these?
Okay. Well, as far as opting out, I'm not even going to get into that, because it depends on what country you live in, and in America, what state you live in. Go to the National Vaccine Information Center, NVIC, and figure that out based on your state, and sign up for their newsletter so that you can know what bills are coming up in what states and what you can do about it. A lot of people call me and they ask me, well, what can I do for my child because I'm not vaccinating? And part of me wants to just roll my eyes and go, oh, because you're not vaccinating, your child's immune system is going to be so much more apt and able to deal with any infection that comes along, especially if that child was born naturally and was given all the stem cells that were supposed to go through the placenta because they didn't have a cord clamping. And if you gave that baby colostrum and breast milk, that baby is ideally set up, especially in today's world where we do have transportation, we do have refrigeration, we have great supplements available to us. It's a great time to be alive in that sense, assuming that you can come into the world in a normal way, which is getting more and more difficult. But if you are, that baby's immune system is in the best possible shape you could ever have it be in. But, you know, like I say, there's a grain of truth to what the pro-vaccines say. So if your child doesn't get a vaccine for pertussis at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, and however many more they're supposed to get, then, yeah, those are, you know, when we look at the vaccinated, unvaccinated studies that do exist, it's fair to say that when they're very young, that they are going to be more likely to get whooping cough if they haven't been vaccinated. But it doesn't mean they're not going to get it. Then when they get older, when those vaccines wear off, which they all do, then those kids are going to end up getting whooping cough. So say you've got a child at home, and this is, again, this is another really complicated subject, but say you've got, you know, an 8-year-old at home and their vaccine is worn off and then you have a new baby. Well, that child can get that 8-year-old can get whooping cough themselves and pass it on to that newborn baby. But more importantly, and this is really, really important, this is a study that was done on baboons, and I'll think of the author's name in a minute, but what they showed was that they compared three groups of baboons. This is the last kind of complicated thing I'm gonna go through, and then I'll stop pontificating. So they found was that the baboons that were vaccinated and then re-exposed to the bacteria, they didn't get the cough themselves, but they harbored the bacteria for up to 6 weeks in very high numbers in their lungs asymptomatically and were able to pass that on to their naive cage mates. Okay, so just take that in for a second and then listen to the second part. The other group of baboons were baboons that were given whooping cough that recovered from it, and then they were re-exposed, and they found that there were no bacteria in the lungs of those baboons, and so they weren't able to pass anything on. And it's, again, it's because of original antigenic sin, which I talk about a lot in Dissolving Illusions. And the article Warfel, W-A-R-F-E-L, knew it would come to me eventually. And I think that was 2014, W-A-R-F-E-L, article on baboons. And it's really important because the truth, the grain of truth that I'm getting at is that, yeah, you know, those freshly vaccinated baboons did not themselves contract pertussis and whooping cough, but they were still able to pass it on. So that's fact number one. But, you know, I do see more non-vaccinated babies getting pertussis than vaccinated babies. Now, is that because I am, you know, those parents are kind of more enlightened in that sense and they're bringing, you know, their kids elsewhere and looking for other, you know, issues. But I think, when you look at the population overall, that when it comes to chickenpox, if you don't get a chickenpox vaccine, you are more likely to get chickenpox. If you don't get a measles vaccine and your measles vaccine is still active, yeah, you might be less susceptible to measles if it comes into the population. So that's a fact. However, whooping cough, even in very young babies, I really wish the medical system would learn how to treat it, because that's really the biggest problem, is that you see these kids gagging and choking and being put on all these machines because the medical system simply refuses to learn how to use vitamin C. I've treated hundreds of babies for whooping cough at home with their parents. And no, it's no walk in the park. It's no picnic. You know, I hate whooping cough. But I've also seen the damage that happens to these 2-month, 4-month, 6-month olds after they're given those high doses of aluminum containing vaccines. And I've seen the studies that are done on rodents that show the brain damage that can happen. Very good studies that have been done through Canadian scientists that I go through in Trojan horses and cluster bombs. So when you weigh that all out, in my opinion, and this is my opinion, my educated opinion, and believe me, I don't have vaccine injured children. I don't even have children. So I don't have, this is not personal for me. This is just simply what I have observed, that it's not worth the trouble. If you're educated and you understand how to take care of a child, you can do it without them being vaccinated. Now, it doesn't mean that you might not be more susceptible to measles if it comes through the population. But most parents are happy when their 4 or 5 year old gets measles. Now, who you don't want to get measles are less than 1 year old babies, which that was never a problem back when the virus was circulating normally, because those mothers got it when they were, you know, children, and they kept that immunity and were able to pass it through the placenta. And vaccinated mothers can't do that. So we're at a disadvantage today. So it's really complicated. But I never say, oh, go to measles party, because you know you don't know who you're going to come in contact with. So you really got to know what you're doing if you're going to intentionally expose your kids to a disease. And I don't think that we should ever take it lightly to go out exposing our children to diseases. I know people do it, but I just advise that you understand how to use vitamin A and vitamin C and have optimal conditions and quarantine. But, you know, it's like I say, it's a very complicated situation. Now, when it comes to HPV, no, I don't think there's any, personally, I think there's no utility for that vaccine whatsoever. I couldn't even support the pro-vaccine side. Like I usually say, if I'm an attorney, I could probably argue either side on some of the other vaccines. But if I'm an attorney, I don't want to have to take up the case for the pro vaccine on HPV. I think it's one of the worst vaccines ever invented, and one of the ones we really don't need.
Wow, that is
hepatitis
amazing.
B on day one of birth, same thing. There's no justification for giving a newborn baby whose mother does not have a chronic carrier state of hepatitis B, a hepatitis B vaccine on day one. I think it's akin to genocide. It's a terrible practice that needs to be stopped. So I'm willing to say those kind of, you know, bold statements about day one hepatitis B vaccine and HPV vaccines. And I'm willing to say that there's a grain of truth to the pro vaccine and some of the other vaccines, but that there's a much bigger picture that parents need to understand. And unfortunately, yeah, you do have to learn this on your own, because we can't trust what we're hearing today, and because there's an epidemic of childhood diseases that don't need to be there. And in my opinion, are largely contributed to by the practice of vaccination.
Wow, amazing. Well, Dr. Suzanne, thank you so much for your time and your incredible research. And I've learned a ton today. I took a ton of notes, so I can better definitely counsel my patients and give them the resources. So, again, everyone listening, thank you so much. Check out Dr. Suzanne's book, Dissolving Illusions. And is there another website you want them to go to besides drsuzanne.net?
Well, the Dissolving Illusions has a website, dissolvingillusions.com, and you can for free see all the color graphs and see the photographs. And I think there's the first page of every chapter. And there was a fairly well orchestrated attack upon the book. And so we put our 70-page rebuttal against that attack on the website so that you can see how we responded to it. And then my other book,
fantastic.
My newer book, is called Rising from the Dead, and that's available on Amazon.
Okay, fantastic. Oh, my gosh. So thank you again so much, and thanks, everyone, for listening. And I'm definitely, what I usually do is I have a little pretty link that I create for my website that goes to each of these radio shows, especially the key ones that I feel are really, really important. And definitely I can't wait to put up that one. So my patients
Good.
Can at
thank
least
you.
Hear from you personally. You know, if they want a third-party validation or verification of some of the counseling I'm doing. So, again, thank you so much, and thanks, everyone, for listening in. Until next time, bye for now.
You're welcome. Bye.